2 Corinthians chapter 9, starting at verse 6. The point is this: whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. As it is written, he has distributed freely, he has given to the poor, his righteousness endures forever. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way, to be generous in every way, which through us will produce thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only supplying the needs of the saints, but it is also overflowing in many thanksgivings to God. By their approval of this service, they will glorify God because of your submission that comes from your confession of the gospel of Christ, and the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others, while they long for you and pray for you because of the surpassing grace of God upon you. Thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift.
Well, thanks, Sophie, for that reading. Well, this final passage in our series, I think it comes alive when you know that it was written 10 years into a devastating famine. How much more breathtaking do these promises seem of seed for sowing and bread on your table when you realize that they were written in the middle of crop failures, when people were struggling to put bread on their table. An inscription dated to this period gives a little taste of the horror of the famine. A famine in the land, flesh-eating, terrible, bearing inescapable death that gripped the whole world. The whole Roman world, that is. Well, Corinth was at the heart of the Roman world, a bustling, entrepreneurial, commercial hub. And so in some ways, it was actually insulated from the worst of the famine, because of its trading, its wealth. A bit like London will be insulated, not totally, but certainly from the worst of the after effects of coronavirus. But 5 years into the famine, even in Corinth, they were feeling the pinch. In AD 50, 5 years before this letter was even written, grain prices were eight times what they had been before the famine. It's really important that when we read these chapters, we hold on tightly to that historical context. Sometimes these chapters, you see, are used by church treasurers, even pastor teachers. I'm sure I've done it myself. People who ought to know better use them to shake the tin for giving to local church ministry, to the budget, to pay for hiring church ministers. But that's simply not what these chapters are about. You know, the New Testament does have things to say about giving to your local church to pay for the local church minister. It goes like this. The worker deserves his wages. It's a simple principle, isn't it? If someone has done some work for you, they deserve a wage. If you wouldn't let an electrician rewire your house for free, or if you wouldn't expect a lecturer to lecture you without paying your fees, then doesn't the church worker who leads and teaches deserve a wage? The worker deserves his wages. Now, of course, at Euston, we just want to say we don't care whether you give or not. If you don't want to give to the local church ministry here, keep coming anyway. We'd rather you benefited from our ministry without paying than not turning up at all. But all the same, do you see the principle? The worker deserves his wages. It is something very different to the passage that we've just had read to us today. This is not about paying workers for a benefit you've already received. It's about giving to poor Christians. Verse 8. God is able to make all grace abound to you so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. What good work does Paul have in mind? Well, verse 9, he says, as it's written, he has distributed freely, he has given to the poor. Verse 9 is a quote from Psalm 112. Psalm 112, you can look it up later if you want. And it pictures the ideal Israelite living in the land of Canaan. Remember the land of Canaan? The land that works for everyone? It's a picture of somebody who gives to those around him in the land who have fallen on hard times, who are in need. Now, again, in our passage today, the giving is clearly from Christians and for Christians. Verse 12, the ministry of this service is supplying the needs of the saints. This passage is not about giving to pay for work that you have benefited from, but about giving to Christians around the globe who have fallen on hard times in a time of famine. Saints, in verse 12, it's a way of talking about ordinary Christians in the New Testament. These are ordinary Christians receiving a contribution for their needs from other ordinary Christians in a time when everybody was struggling with inflated food prices and devastating famine. And in this context of famine, when crops are failing, again, aren't the words of Paul extraordinary? Verse 6. Whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. Whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. You see, giving to Christian family around the globe who are in need, it's a bit like a farmer who buys lots of seed, invests big in his seed to sow bountifully in order to then reap a bumper harvest. Now again, the context is that there were crop failures everywhere that are the big cause of the famine. No farmers wanted to invest in seed at the moment because they weren't going to see a bumper harvest. There weren't going to be returns on their investment. Do you see the point? In a time of insecurity, when no other investment looks safe, there is a place to put your money with God-given guaranteed returns. And that place is giving to poor fellow Christians who are struggling to put food on their plate. It's counterintuitive, isn't it? You'd think, wouldn't you, that giving to people in that way, just giving away your money, would make you poorer, that it wouldn't guarantee you any return at all. But Paul says this kind of giving guarantees great returns. So bountifully to reap bountifully, so big to reap big. The bigger your investment portfolio in giving to the poor, the bigger the profits you stand to make. Now, what could those profits be? What could that reaping actually involve? What is the harvest you'll get back? Well, before we answer that, just look a little bit further into verse 7, where Paul makes a further claim on the basis of this investment, agricultural type metaphor. Verse 7, each one must give as he has decided in his heart, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Do you see how that fits with verse 6? If giving to poor Christians is a profitable investment for me, the giver, then I should want to give. I should give gladly. It should be a no-brainer. Now, investment normally involves risk, doesn't it? Just like sowing seed. Who knows whether the crops will fail or produce a great harvest this year? Normally, the gladness comes when you reap the harvest, when you see the returns on your investment, but not here. Here, the gladness is in the very act of sowing, of investing, of giving. Why? Well, I take it because we can give with absolute trust that the returns are guaranteed because the one who guarantees them is utterly powerful and trustworthy. God himself, verse 8, and God is able to make all grace abound to you. He is the one who guarantees the profitability of giving to the poor. It's a God-guaranteed, gilt-edged investment. No wonder then God loves a cheerful giver. Glad giving flows from trust in him. Trust that he really can provide a return on your investment. So we've got a one-point sermon again today. Give gladly to the poor, for gilt-edged returns guaranteed by God. Give gladly, because God guarantees the returns. Now, you might be thinking this all sounds a bit crass. I mean, this isn't Dragon's Den, is it? Aren't we talking about giving out of a heart of love here? Surely we shouldn't be talking about giving because of what I can get out of it, should we? What's that got to do with love in the time of coronavirus? Well, if you've been following the sermon series so far, you'll know by now that actually this kind of giving, it does flow from a heart of love, and yet it is all the same, always a win-win for the getter as well as for the giver. Haven't we seen that the whole way through? Everybody wins when we give to the poor Christian family that we have around the world. All right then, let's get down to business. What are the returns that we stand to make? Well, I think there are two big returns in this passage. Let's look at the first in verses 8 to 12. The first return, it is abundant gifts for more abundant good works. Abundant gifts for more abundant good works. Look at verse 8 with me. God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. Again, the good work we're particularly thinking about in this context is giving to the poor, giving to poor saints. So verse 9 makes that clear because it goes on to talk about the righteousness of the man who cares for the poor. But what is this abounding grace at the start of verse 8? God able to make all grace abound to you. What is that grace? Well, I think the following clause in verse 8 explains, doesn't it? So that having all sufficiency in all things at all times. All sufficiency, all things, all times. The three alls here give us a triple lock guarantee. Your every need met, all sufficiency, with everything you could need, all things, every base covered, and just when you need it, at all times, always, all you could ever want or need. That's what God promises to give us here. The word translated sufficiency by the ESV, the version of the Bible we're looking at in verse 8 here, it can mean an objective state of having what is sufficient, so a bank balance that is in the black. Or it can mean a subjective contentment with what you've got. And given the way Paul keeps saying all, I take it that he's meaning both these things here. God is promising to meet our subjective desires and our objective material needs. He's promising that if we get giving, then he will make sure that we always have all we want, whether because he's put contentment in our heart or cash in our bank or both. Doesn't that sound good? And this idea, although it sounds good, can actually sound a bit dodgy to us, can't it? Do you know why? I wonder if you've already thought about it. Doesn't it sound a bit like that false gospel, the prosperity gospel? That God would give us material stuff in return for our giving? Isn't that the very kind of teaching we teach against at Euston Church? Well, let me say that this is very different to the false promises of the prosperity gospel. And we'll think about how in a second. But first of all, I want to say that it's not different in this point. Paul is really talking about, at least in part, being provided for materially by God here. Look at verses 10 and 11. He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. Now, you can take this promise of God multiplying your seed for sowing in two ways. It could be a metaphor or it could be literal. Let's think about it. If it's a metaphor, what would it be a metaphor for? Well, in verses 6 and 7, sowing seed is a metaphor for, did you see there? Giving money to the poor. So what is seed in that metaphor? Well, it's money. But if this isn't a metaphor, then it's just literal seed. And it still amounts to material wealth because physical seed is a physical asset which produces another physical asset, crops, which then make money at market. You see, either way you read it, Paul is talking about God providing for us materially here. Also, why wouldn't we just assume that God is talking about, that Paul is talking about God providing materially? God is the one, verse 10, who gives everybody their food. That's what the Psalms say, Psalm 104. Everybody looks for their food from his hand. That's what Jesus taught. God feeds the birds and he's going to feed you physically. He'll give you what you need. God is, verse 11, the one who enriches us in every way. I guess every way, by definition, includes material riches as well, doesn't it? Now again, how is this not the prosperity gospel? There's a picture of a guy coming up on the screen. Do you know who this is? I think we're going to get the picture up. There you go. This is Kenneth Copeland, a prosperity gospel preacher who flies around the world in his private jet. I think he's got several private jets, but there you go. Well, let me say, God doesn't enrich us so that we can fly around the world in luxury. Did you see verse 11? And verse 10, for that matter. He gives us seed to sow to increase the harvest of our righteousness. He enriches us to make us more generous so that we actually have something material to keep giving away. He supplies seed so that we can keep caring for the needy. And verse 8, the sufficiency he supplies, it's so that we can abound in every good work. Do you get the point? That could not be more different to the selfish greed of the prosperity gospel, which promotes self-enrichment, not sharing. Rampant greed, not generous righteousness. If you've ever been taken in by a prosperity gospel preacher who has ripped verse 6 out of context, which they love to do, I hope you'll know better from now on. Benny Hinn cannot claim to be rich in righteousness when he owns several multi-million dollar mansions, has $42 million in the bank, and private jets parked on an airstrip, whilst poor Christians face food poverty. You see, these chapters, they might be a favourite of prosperity preachers. Give to us to be enriched in every way, they say. But how evil is that when you see these chapters in their proper context? And that's why it's so important that we keep insisting on their proper context. This isn't about giving to local church ministers, but about giving away your money to the poor around the world in the church. Not give to Rob Mullock so that he can get rich so that you can get rich, but give to the poor around the world so that their needs are met, so that your needs can be richly met. Do you see the difference? Don't be duped. But also, please, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. God will take care of your material needs if you get giving, if you give big. That's what he is promising here. Do you believe it? You know, I don't think this is a hard passage to understand. I think it's just a hard passage to believe. Do you believe what Paul is writing here? Do you believe that this really is God's promise to you, to take care of you, to enrich you in every way if you will invest in giving? Do you believe? Do you believe in God? That's what it all boils down to. In times of uncertainty, people flock to safe havens for their money, don't they? Safe investments. I remember during the time of the financial crisis, people were even buying up cases of very rare wines because they thought they might hold the value of their investments. Well, let me say that nowhere could be safer than buying into investments backed by the one who provides seed for sowing and bread for eating to all mankind. Do you believe in his power to provide? Do you know, in fact, forget that. This isn't just putting your money somewhere safe. This is about sowing into fertile soil. This is about investing in something that will provide big profits. Not just conserving what you have, but growing what you have in every way. Growing your sufficiency, your capital to invest, putting bread on your table, growing your contentment, growing your generosity, growing your righteousness. Doesn't that sound like a good investment? I hope it does. Well, so much for the first return. The second return now in verses 12 to 14. Giving will produce thanksgiving. Did you see that in verses 12 to 14? Paul promises that their giving is going to lead to loads of thanksgiving to God amongst the churches who receive their giving. So verse 12, the ministry of this service is not only supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing in many thanksgivings to God. You see, the Corinthians' giving, it doesn't just meet the material needs of poor Christians in Jerusalem. It helps grow them spiritually as well. Because what could be more spiritual than a Christian with a heart full of thanks to God? And that's what the Corinthians' giving is going to produce in the Jewish Christians in Judea and Jerusalem. Thankful hearts. That's remarkable, isn't it? God is promising to use the Corinthians' giving to help these Jewish Christians in every way, physically, materially, and spiritually. We often say, don't we, that our love for one another proves to the watching world, to unbelievers, non-Christians, that the gospel really works. But actually in this passage, I mean, that is true, but in this passage we see a different angle. If you give to poor Christians, it proves to them that the gospel really works. Because it is the gospel that produces this kind of giving. Did you see verse 13? By their approval of this service, they will glorify God because of your submission that comes from your confession of the gospel of Christ. The one who, being rich, became poor, that we, by his poverty, might become rich, and not least, rich in giving. And yet sometimes, isn't it hard for us to swallow the dynamic here in this passage, that the people we give to should give glory back to, not us, but God. Verse 13, they will glorify God. See, normally when we give, we want the glory to go to us, don't we? We might get a little bit poorer, but at least we've got the compensation of everybody thinking that we're great people. What a good bloke for giving like that. But not here. The glory goes to God. And yet if we're Christians who pray, Father, hallowed be your name, that should be something we want. You see, really, this passage is about love. Whether we love God and the glory of his name. But you know, actually, it's even better than that, because it's not actually a strict either or here. You see, God gets glory, but we, the givers, get something too. Did you see it in verse 14? What are the Jewish Christians going to do for the Greek Christians in Corinth? Well, they will long for you and pray for you. Do you know that feeling you get when your friend or family member is far away and you just want to be with them? I assume that you're experiencing that feeling all the time at the moment. That longing, verse 14. I read an article this week on the BBC News website about how grandmas up and down the country are longing to hug their grandchildren again. Well, that's how these poor Christians will feel about the Christians who've given to them. Even as they glorify God, they will love the Corinthians. They will long for them. Do you see how remarkable this passage is? I mean, we just said, didn't we, that if you give, you stand to gain personally in every way. The first return God promises to generous givers is to give them all they need so that their generosity can never run out, so that they have all sufficiency for their own needs. Me giving to you would be good for me. So why should you love me so much? Why should you long for me when I've just done something that's good for me? Why should you? But you would though, wouldn't you? Because that's how we work as human beings. When someone gives to me to meet my needs, I do grow in my affection for them. Even as I glorify God for his work in their lives to produce that generosity. A win-win for everybody. Do you see then the grace of God? The chance to give for others' needs is one of the greatest gifts God gives us as Christians. We get the chance to use gifts that God gave us in the first place for others' good and for our own good, with the guarantee of getting yet more gifts to keep giving for others' good and for our own good, and with another guarantee of God getting glory through us and us getting the love of those who get our giving. What a gift! What a gift! Do you see why Paul breaks out into this exclamation in verse 15? Thanks be to God for his inexpressible gift. Anya's got a friend, our women's worker, she's got a friend back in Germany who says this, that whenever she tries to give something away for God, she finds it's impossible because she always gets back so much more than she has given. That's what this passage is teaching. You see, just at the very point that we start to give big, we discover that the biggest giver of all, from start to finish, always has been and always will be our great giving God. All the glory be to him.